This is an ABC podcast.
Bulawinaka, good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. The coronavirus pandemic not only affects people's physical health, all the lockdowns and states of emergencies can really take its toll on a family's well-being and people's mental health.
We are not alone in this. We felt the loss of workers. We felt that the families were not, there was panic inside the families. And there was also a lot of stress.
Coming up on the show, you'll hear from the Samoa Victims Support Group about what they are doing to help families through this crisis. And the drama around who will chair the World Rugby Council continues to swirl, with a global vote set to take place over the weekend. You'll hear about Fiji's position on the issue a little later on in the program. But first, a new report has shown that Australia, New Zealand, and many countries in the Pacific have slipped when it comes to media freedoms. You'll hear more about what this means, especially during the time of this COVID-19 pandemic, next. All these stories and more coming up on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
The latest COVID-19 figures from the Pacific show that the region appears to have largely managed to stop the spread of the virus, with very few new cases confirmed across the region this week. The total number of reported cases since March stands at 261, but as the number of people who recover from COVID-19 continues to grow, the actual number of active cases is now at around 40. That suggests that the strict rules about people's movements and bans on public gatherings are working. But experts say people shouldn't become complacent. In some places in the Pacific, testing has been quite limited, which could mean these figures don't quite portray the full picture. And in all of this, journalists and news organisations have been playing a key role in getting information about the virus and the various states of emergency out to the people. But the coronavirus emergency has left some people worried that governments, not just in the Pacific but globally, are using it to control the media. That comes as a new report from a media watchdog, Reporters Without Borders, has shown many countries in the region, including Australia and New Zealand, have slipped in their latest media freedom rankings. To talk about all of this and more on media freedoms, I am joined by David Roby, the director of Pacific Media Centre. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning.
In what ways are governments reportedly using tough controls for the media during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, it's a pretty major concern in some parts of the Pacific in particular, which is reflecting the concerns right across the globe now. But particularly Papua New Guinea and Fiji, two countries that have been singled out in particular by Reporters Without Borders. That's actually RSF have put out two reports in the last week or so, criticising both countries actually for transgressions. But it is a global problem. The concern is that countries like Fiji and Papua New Guinea, where there's been a tendency for authoritarianism anyway, they're actually sort of using the cover, if you like, of the pandemic to exert even more difficulties and controls on the media.
You mentioned there Papua New Guinea, where media briefings have been curtailed with a lockdown of national information and operations. But isn't it just being responsible to limit the risk of journalists' health, especially when COVID-19 has been found at Murauta House, which is where the journalists were attending media conferences? Wouldn't it have been irresponsible to keep holding media briefings at a place where there'd been a confirmed case?
Well, there's an argument definitely for that. But there are other incidents that have been happening that actually are sort of exerting control on the media. And I think, for example, we had this case just recently with the police minister, Brian Cramer. Ironically, Cramer's actually had quite a reputation when he was opposition MP for transparency and freedom of information. But recently he applied pressure on two of the most prominent journalists in Papua New Guinea. Gorothy Kenneth, she's a leading reporter on the Post Courier. And then also Freddie Mo from Loop PNG for their reporting on how the budget that was allocated for the pandemic was being spent, and allegations that were being made that part of the budget was being spent on consultants and hire cars and so on. And this information came out of an interview with the Treasurer. There was Brian Cramer sort of stepped in and said, look, hang on, the Treasurer has been misquoted, and he sort of called for the sacking of these two journalists. So that's the sort of harassment that is being made use of under the pandemic. But I have to mention that there's quite a concern in Papua New Guinea in particular for its neighbouring Melanesian provinces of Papua and West Papua. They're of course, two provinces just across the border that are administered by Indonesia. And that border is about 820 kilometres long and quite porous. And three of the cases that are in Papua New Guinea, the three out of eight confirmed cases, are in Western Province adjoining that border. And it's well known that there's quite a serious problem already in both Papua and West Papua. I think the total, I believe the total is around about 226 confirmed cases and seven deaths. So there's a lot of concern and fear that, you know, the porous border, that there could be spreading of cases across the border. So that's actually been reflected with pressure on the media and so on as well. We've had just recently the SEPAK governor, Alan Bird, who actually called, well, we need to have an order put in place, something like shoot to kill, which caused a lot of controversy at the time. And I don't know how serious he was about that call, but what the point he was really trying to make is there wasn't a sufficient enough security policy on the border.
And you were speaking there about how there is a lot of fear around the coronavirus, especially with the porous borders with the West Papua provinces near PNG. But we've seen rumours spread quickly through the Pacific about COVID-19, usually on social media. And governments do, I guess, need to control the message and make sure that people are getting accurate information. Should there be exceptions made for governments in unprecedented times like this?
Well, you know, this is absolutely illustrates, you know, really underscores the importance of having free media and media that's actually journalists well-informed and really working in the public interest. Sometimes the governments can be quite overbearing in the message that they put across. There's an extreme level of sensitivity, and this is what happened with the complaints by RSF, for example, over Fiji, with the arrest of broadcasters and so on, and some of the comments that were being made on social media. But it just really just underscores the fact that it's really important to have free media right across the region. And even in good times, there's a tendency for a lot of governments in the Pacific to really not understand the role of the media and how important it is to get good, reliable information. And that's really the antidote to rumours on social media.
Now, turning to the 2020 Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index that was also recently released, it's based on the past year, so well before COVID-19. How did the Pacific countries go?
Well, it hasn't been a good year, to be absolutely honest, and bear in mind that this report is largely around 2019. That's the information that's really gathered, although it's only just come out, of course, but that's reflecting mostly 2019, and so it doesn't reflect some of the things that have happened in the last two or three months or so during the height of the pandemic. We can say that it's a really difficult situation when almost all the countries have actually dropped. I mean, for example, take Australia. And Australia's actually had a sliding position with the World Press Index now for a few years. But so they're now in the 26th position. That's down 5 places. And then you've got Fiji. Well, Fiji's been more or less no change, but it's in a bad place anyway, 52nd. And New Zealand slipped as well. Now, New Zealand's usually done fairly well. It's usually been in the 10 top places of world breast freedom, but it's dropped two places down to seventh this time. And then Papua New Guinea also dropped eight places. Samoa, not too bad, only just down a place to 22nd. And the irony is Timor-Leste. Now, Timor-Leste is not always covered as part of the Pacific, but we certainly look at it as very much part of the Pacific for a variety of reasons, not only the fact that many of the journalists have actually sort of gone to, say, journalism schools in Papua New Guinea and things like that. But we do look at it as a part of the Pacific, and it's actually did really quite well. It's up six places, reflecting some really good media freedom issues that are actually happening in Timor. But overall, it's looking pretty bleak. And Australia, of course, we've had the police raids last year, in June last year. On the Canberra-based political reporter and also the ABC headquarters in Sydney. And these were regarded as absolutely flagrant violations of the confidentiality of journalist sources and public interest journalism by the Reporters Without Borders report. So it's not surprising that Australia has actually dropped down quite a few places again this year.
You're right. Australia has fallen five places and New Zealand has dropped as well, as you mentioned. And yet they like to portray themselves as the bigger brothers of the Pacific. But do these results suggest they're not the role models that they think they are to the Pacific?
Well, sadly, that's very true. They're no longer really the role models that have been traditionally in place. For years, I lived in the Pacific for 10 years myself, both in Fiji and Papua New Guinea. And, for years, both Australia and New Zealand were regarded as beacons of press freedom. And so journalists right through the region were able to look to Australia and New Zealand, particularly for support on media freedom issues, because these issues keep coming up in all Pacific countries. So Australia and New Zealand were sort of looked upon as examples that could be pointed to as best practice and so on, and media freedom issues and that sort of thing. And so that reputation is certainly being very dented, certainly in Australia's case. So it's a bit disappointing, really.
Finally, David, you mentioned before that, overall it is looking pretty bleak across the region. What can journalists do to make sure that the media is still free in the Pacific?
Well, I think journalism activism is really important for media freedom. It's a matter of being vigilant all the time. The good thing is, in the Pacific, there are a lot of groups that actually sort of work very hard for media freedom issues. And I think the Pacific Freedom Forum is one, there's the Pacific Media Watch, various others, been a number of others. But there are a lot of journalists right across the region that are very conscious of media freedom issues because they keep coming up. They really act strongly to defend media freedom. I think both in Australia and New Zealand, sometimes we tend to be a bit complacent about this, taking it for granted, whereas journalists in the Pacific are very, very sensitive on media freedom issues.
David Robey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was David Robey, Director of the Pacific Media Centre at Auckland University of Technology, on the line from New Zealand. He also manages the Pacific Media Watch Freedom Project, which works with the global group Reporters Without Borders that produced the annual Press Freedom Ranking.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat and my name is Jordan Fennell. While coronavirus restrictions are somewhat easing in Papua New Guinea's capital, Port Moresby, the government is telling citizens they'll need to get used to a new normal. And in that new normal, there are fears for the city's most vulnerable. Without a formal welfare system, the city council is using church networks to get food to people living with disabilities, the sick and the elderly. But there could be a growing list of those in need, with thousands of people having lost their jobs in the formal sector, and many more informal workers without their regular incomes as well. Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby.
Thank you.
Ganiga Rea is an 80-year-old widow who lives in the coastal village of Hanuabada in the capital, Port Moresby. She's just received a box of food donated by business houses and the Port Moresby City Council, but delivered by her local church.
I used to
rely on the church. So I said, my God is good. And I can tell you that our God is good, not mine, ours, all of us.
26-year-old Gewage Heagi lives next door. She has Down syndrome and lives with her retired parents.
It's going to be 26,
yes.
May 29.
Yep. So that's the mother and that's the father.
Hello.
Church leaders are going door to door, following a list with around 200 people who need help in the community. They're among the first churches in Port Moresby to be provided these food boxes as part of the City Council's COVID-19 emergency response. There's sweet potato, pumpkin, cassava and green bananas inside, as well as noodles, biscuits and portions of pork. Churches have often provided these kinds of gifts to people in need, using the money given at weekly services to fund the activities. But with the government banning church gatherings, that source of income has mostly dried up. So the City Council has allocated 1.5 million kina. That's around 660,000 Australian dollars, while several local business houses are also donating goods. Reverend Aigo Baru is part of the delivery team.
Monthly, church distributes 50 kina to each person, and we will be using the same list to distribute this food to these orphans and disabled people.
Seeing the breakup of the food, is it enough, and do you think that this needs to continue until the lockdown is lifted?
We see it should. This will make it for roughly a week, but then the lockdown is still a month away.
Nearly 50 other churches are expected to distribute basic food essentials throughout the city. But with thousands of people losing their jobs as businesses have been forced to close because of the shutdowns, there's likely to be a growing need. There is no welfare system and life is already tough, especially for those who live in Port Moresby's densely populated settlements, where many families survive on less than $5 a day. The Port Moresby Governor, Powys Parkop, says people who call the city home need all the support they can get.
This exercise now, part of our plan, is to feed only those who need it. This is a time for love, compassion and understanding. We are reaching out to everyone.
It's unlikely, though, they will reach everyone. But the business owners are vowing to keep helping over the next month as the lockdown continues.
We will continue to support such programs in this future.
Do our best to do back to the country. This is what can we do.
You know, one plato pisang yung misa toko san. Kubla time. Time no good, you mean master one time. Thank you.
But with so much uncertainty about how the virus could still affect PNG and dire predictions for its economy this year, there may be more bad times than good ahead.
Reporter Bethany Harriman there in Port Moresby. Now for the latest on the weather in the region, I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Jordan.
How's the weather looking in the region?
Yeah, look, it's much improved, certainly around Fiji and Tonga, which have been experiencing some heavy rain lately. There's still a few clouds about Tonga, but most of the rain is clearing away to the east now and the clouds are dissipating. A little bit of cloud across Samoa today too. It might get the odd shower, but nothing nearly as hazardous as our friends in Fiji have experienced in the last few days. But west of the dateline, it's looking absolutely marvellous. Pretty much Melanesia all the way from PNG across to Vanuatu and New Caledonia, including the Solomons. There's really plenty of sunshine today, just the odd cloud about here and there, and could get an afternoon shower if you're lucky. But on the whole, it looks pretty bright, and there's certainly a change in seasons happening right now as the weather continues to grow in extent north of the equator. So we'll be watching to see what happens over coming weeks up there.
And what will the weather be like across the Pacific for the weekend?
Feeling like a pretty good weekend for most people. I think that certainly all of Melanesia again, and certainly Fiji and Tonga by then will be clear, and perhaps a few early showers on Saturday around Samoa, but for the most of the weekend it should be pretty good. And further east around the Cooks, there may be a bit of weather up in the far northern part of the Cook Islands, but not a lot of folks up that way, so it probably shouldn't affect too many people. So all in all, a pretty decent sort of a weekend. But of course, everybody must remember to stay inside and distance themselves and maintain the COVID-19 protocol. So don't get too carried away with your weekend plans.
Yeah, an important reminder there. It is obviously hard to stay inside if it's sunny and beautiful out there. But yes, reminder to social distance and stay at home if you can. I know here in Melbourne, I will be staying inside because it will be wet and rainy, which is perfect weather for social distancing. Neville, exactly. What are your plans for the weekend?
I'm actually still in Australia myself. Unfortunately, the options for getting back home are still pretty limited. So I'll be enjoying the cold, brisk, wintry weather with you, but over here in Adelaide, where I'm based at the moment.
Wonderful. Well, yes, we will stay inside, and hopefully everyone in the Pacific does as well. Neville, thank you so much for those updates.
You're welcome.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather, giving us the latest weather update. And for weather updates at any time, you can search Nandraki Weather on Facebook. That's Nandraki, spelt Nadraki. Now it's time to bring you all the latest news from across the region, and to do that I am joined by Marla Damati. Good morning, Marla.
Good morning, Jordan.
Now, the United States has made their feelings known in the Pacific about the importance of accurate information in the COVID-19 pandemic.
That is right. The United States is stressing the importance of countries sharing accurate information about COVID-19, and this was said in an editorial for several Pacific countries, and it actually seemed like it was a bit of a swipe at China. The United States Ambassador to Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, Erin McKee, has written an editorial for local media. It says that the COVID-19 pandemic is a reminder of the critical importance of human rights. And it says, because our very lives depend on it, we expect our political leaders and their scientific advisors to tell us the truth. Now, the editorial goes on to say that authoritarian systems expose their weaknesses in a time of crisis, and to say it is contrary to the very concept of human rights to suppress communication of critical public health information, which is what we were having a conversation about with David Roby earlier in terms of media freedom and importance of giving out correct information. Now, the ambassador is fairly new in her role, taking up her post in November of last year. And this also comes as Australia and the US push for China to allow an independent inquiry into the origin of coronavirus.
Yeah, very interesting. We'll have to keep our eye on that. Now, the Niuean government has formalised one of the largest marine reserves in the world. What's happened?
Well, like you said, Niue's enormous marine reserve, the Moana Mahu Marine Protected Area, has now officially been formalised. The 127 square kilometre zone constitutes about 40% of Niue's exclusive economic zone. Now, it was first kind of brought up about 5 years ago. The Moana Mahu has this month been legally established by the Niuean Parliament. Now, the reserve will include special management space area around the partially submerged Beveridge Reef, and this will be known as the Beveridge Reef Special Management Area. And the size of it, what's interesting about this is that the size of the zone relative to the country's total area makes it the second largest reserve in the world, and this is after Palau. And Niue is now calling on other countries to follow suit and protect the marine areas around their country.
And finally, a PSA from Belgian farmers that I can definitely get behind. They're asking the people of Belgium to eat more of something to support them in this time of the pandemic. What are they urging Belgians to eat?
Well, funny that you mention this, that I put into the news wrap. Belgian farmers are asking the people of Belgium to eat more French fries. I know, that is correct. I'm not joking. Belgium is actually one of the world's largest exporter of fries and other frozen potato products. Its processors convert about 5.3 million tons of potatoes into fries, mash, and potato chips per year, and sending them to customers for more than 160 countries. Now, in the time of coronavirus, though, the demand for potatoes is going down. So a lot of these farmers have a surplus of potatoes and nowhere to feed them. I mean, they can drop it off in my backyard. That's fine. I'll be happy to take them. Now, restrictions have halted a lot of cafes and restaurants which normally take these potatoes. And in Belgium, some 750,000 tons of potatoes would not be processed this year as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. And, you know, some of these potatoes actually can't be used for other culinary uses that isn't French fries. So please, Belgians, if you're listening, buy French fries, eat French fries, pommes frites, have it in mash, have some potatoes. But yes, please eat the potatoes.
That is tasty, tasty news, Marla. Thank you so much for that.
My pleasure.
That was our reporter, Marla Damati, bringing you all the latest news from around the region.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat and my name is Jordan Fennell. The vaccine that most people are talking about nowadays is one for COVID-19. And the question is, when will scientists come up with one? But this week, there have been countless reminders about making sure we get our regular shots for diseases like measles. And that's because it's been World Immunization Week. Experts say Samoa's measles outbreak late last year really highlighted what can happen when there are low vaccination rates within a community. 83 people died there, mostly children, and there were around 5,700 cases. One organisation that was instrumental in supporting families in Samoa during that emergency was the Samoa Victim Support Group. The not-for-profit group was initially set up to support victims of sexual crimes, but has since extended its work to help victims of any kind, whether it be domestic violence, harassment in the workplace, or victims of poverty. And their attention has had to change again. They're now working around the clock to offer support and care to families who have been impacted by COVID-19, and not just the disease itself, but the impact of the emergency shutdowns. Lena Chang is the president of the Samoa Victim Support Group and spoke to the ABC's Talia Olatia.
It's all about saving lives, Tali, and that's why we people here are busy with the child protection. It's something that Victim Support has been working together with the UNICEF, and we're quite happy and passionate with what we're doing. But making sure first that our children inside the campus have been fully immunized so that they are free from these measles. Once we made sure that the children in the campus are okay, then we started our mission in working with the children outside of the campus.
How much of an emotional toll as well as a physical toll did that take? You know, every single day going out to the families, looking after people with 83 deaths, it couldn't have been easy.
Very emotional, Tali, very emotional. It was that time that our group came together. And because Victim Support treats Samoa as one family, and we don't look at differences or anything, the only thing that we wanted during the measles outbreak is bringing everybody together and just creating this family so that we can support each other. It wasn't easy because people did not plan for it, and it was so sudden, just losing a life. So what we went out there trying to be positive in a way that we are there just to save lives, and meaning that giving them a smile, making sure that there is family there, bringing along the psychosocial support and the counseling. And just like I said, Tali, it wasn't easy. I can see how Samoa is now responded to the COVID, and that's because a lot of lessons learned from the measles. And that is, if you tell people that time to stay away, they don't. But with the measles, you know, a lot of lessons learned now. That's why people are now following the COVID rules placed by the government. So that's how I think that's how we people are responding positively to at this point of time. And also for us, with the experience that we have, not attending funerals, it's something that we are now we're giving out awareness to people. Not only we visit them, we tell them, we're giving out awareness that you know, life is very important, that we still have to obey, and that it's because that we know nothing about the COVID, we can only hear because we haven't seen. So we still have to be obedient and obey all these things. But it's so good, and that's due to the lessons learned from the measles. Yeah.
And now, obviously, it being World Immunisation Week, has it really stressed to the Samoan community and the Pacific community at large just how important vaccinations are?
Yes. At this point of time, people are now quite aware that vaccination is very important. It was something that you remember that it was something that happened in Samoa, and that really spurred our people not to get their children vaccinated. But now they fully believed, and now they know that it's been expected from them to take on responsibility of having their children vaccinated.
As you were saying, during the measles outbreak, you didn't kind of have any warning, but now you're helping people with the global pandemic with COVID-19. What's that been like?
Yes. It wasn't expected as well. We do operate the helpline, and that helpline, it's been assisted, and now we are funded to give out the best response to our people through the UNDP Spotlight Initiative that we are partnering with them now. And it's quite an encouragement to us, because we are not alone in this. We felt the loss of workers. We felt that the families were not, there was panic inside the families. And there was also a lot of stress. No matter what, there's always something there that will trigger the moment. So we managed to help out. But then at the same time, with the helpline ringing, there's also that welfare request. And people all over Samoa that have lost their jobs, that, you know that it's not as if we do have money every day. So we're used to that kind of life. And then just immediately having nothing at all, it's quite a burden for our families here, because a lot of our families here, you know, they depend on the remittances from overseas. There have been family, they have, especially with the elderly, that they expected that there's always money coming from overseas, remittances from their children. Remember in Samoa, there was a time that all the buses were closed, so there was no transport going to town. And that's the only way that they are able to come and pick up the money. But then at the same time, their children overseas were not able to send the money. And probably it's about the new systems. Instead of going to the banks, they don't have that system to just transfer from their phones. So it's everything connected with them. But with the domestic violence, yes, ANZ Bank has stepped up. Donating money to us to help us and assist us in our response team to the domestic violence, which is very welcome, and it comes at the right time for us.
I did see, and it was a very generous donation, which no doubt does help, because as you say, your helplines are ringing off the phones 24 hours a day, you do have a lot of demand for your services. So because normally, how are you guys funded? How can you keep afloat considering everything that keeps happening?
That's a good question. Victim support is well embedded in our community in Samoa. It's bringing our people together, and that's how we help. We have been doing a lot of donations to help us out, but then at the same time, people here and there from all over the world have been helping us through our Kiva Little page so that we are still able to sustain and go forward. To me, this is very important, because it's the belief of the people to victim support, and it's quite an encouragement for us to still continue. And then you can see the faces of all these children, people who need help, and just having that smile makes you continue. Yeah.
I was about to ask how you remain so positive and so happy when you're constantly, you know, dealing with people who have such emotional needs. Does it take a toll on
darling.
You?
What a nice question. we try to make ourselves positive at all times. And especially you just arrived inside a family and a family just called out, oh, Mama Lina is here. It's amazing. It's amazing how people expected to see us. And then, you know, everything that they're carrying, it just disappeared. And then that smile comes out. And then you keep on smiling, feeling that, oh, my goodness, you know, those people have been sitting there expecting us to come. But then God is with us all the time. And that's how this group works. And we believe in God that anything and everything is possible.
That was President of the Samoa Victim Support Group, Lena Chang, speaking there to ABC's Talia Olatia. And if you want to keep up to date with the work the group is doing, you can follow them on Facebook and on YouTube as well. You'll find them at Samoa Victim Support Group.
In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Always check the source of information you read, and don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure it's from a trusted source. To find accurate, up-to-date information about the coronavirus, search for ABC Radio Australia, the World Health Organization, or your country's government, online or on Facebook. Being well informed will help protect you and your community from the coronavirus.
This is Pacific Beat and my name is Jordan Fennell. A virtual global vote will take place over the weekend to decide who will be in the chair at the World Rugby Council for the next 4 years. The incumbent, England's Sir Bill Beaumont, or the challenger, Argentina's Gus Pichot. There's growing speculation that the result could be too close to call and that Fiji's Prime Minister, Frank Bainimarama, who also happens to be the president of the Fiji Rugby Union, could have the final say. The FIU had been backing Sir Bill until their World Rugby delegate, Francis Keane, resigned amid a scandal over his criminal record and allegations of homophobia last month. And since then, there's been speculation that Fiji have swapped sides. Meanwhile, there are calls for World Rugby to stop lecturing the Pacific on governance and overhaul their own outdated system, which allowed Keane to sit at the council table in the first place.
A cloud of poor governance has hung over Pacific Rugby for years. Interventions by World Rugby have been frequent, and right now they're busy trying to sort out the mess that is the Tongan Rugby Union. But after the Francis Keane affair threw up the possibility of a convicted killer becoming one of World Rugby's power brokers, the spotlight is now very firmly on the ruling body itself. In the UK, Cambridge law graduate Ben Cisneros is the author of the blog Rugby and the Law, and he says the Keane case has exposed the fact that World Rugby's own system of governance is poor.
Really, World Rugby has no checks on who can and cannot sit on its council and on its executive committee. There are various provisions about misconduct, but it's not specifically aimed at those wishing to apply for positions on World Rugby councils and committees, and therefore there's nothing really to stop someone like Francis Keane getting elected, as proved to be the case.
So now Cisneros says whoever wins the chairmanship vote should ensure that World Rugby modernises its governance system as a matter of urgency.
World Athletics has a really good regime in place where they have almost a vetting panel. FIFA has something similar. So if you want to be an official of World Athletics, you want to be on their committees, then you have to satisfy eligibility criteria if you have certain offences on your record or if you're bankrupt. And then also there's a general power for this vetting panel to look into your background and make a decision as to whether you represent the standards of integrity that the sport wants to have.
The question then is which chairman is more likely to oversee that kind of change, the incumbent Beaumont or the challenger Pichot? Well, Australia have put their weight behind the Argentinian, and the former Wallaby Totai Kefu says he can understand why.
Billy Beaumont's been in the role now for 4 years, for one cycle, and I don't think Australia have really had any foothold in the power game. And, you know, I think they're just looking at someone they can rely on to have more of an input into the big decisions.
Of Tongan heritage, Kefu is now that country's national coach. Right now, though, Tonga doesn't have a vote. But what if they did?
We would give him our vote, and I think we would probably be better served under Pichot, especially being from the Southern Hemisphere himself and probably being able to shake the game up a bit. We haven't really progressed much in the last couple of Rugby World Cup cycles, so I think from Tonga's point of view, probably be served better under Pichot as well.
Curiously, Samoa are understood to be backing Beaumont, who in return has pledged to take another look at the thorny question of player eligibility rules, which have impacted negatively on the Pacific nations for years.
It's interesting to see how he would relook at that when, in the past, he never has. But when it's time for re-election, his statement of relooking at the eligibility rules is probably because he's looking for votes out of the Pacific.
The SRU do have a vote on the World Rugby Council, and their seat at the table is occupied by the Prime Minister, Tuia Lepisalele, a situation that Ben Cisneros says should also come under scrutiny.
We all want to respect different cultural traditions, and we should understand the role rugby plays in different different countries. And obviously in the Pacific Islands, it has a heightened role than in many other countries around the world. But ultimately, we all want the best for these islands in terms of modern rugby and the professional era. And it is my feeling, and I think shared by many others, that these sorts of involvements by state officials maybe hold countries back in rugby terms. But generally, the fear is that, you know, state involvement might ultimately sort of jeopardise the quality of decision making and the good governance of the game. But the last thing I would say on the issue of the Samoa Prime Minister being on the World Rugby Council is that there's nothing in the World Rugby regulations or bylaws to prevent him from being there.
And Cisneros says that's a situation that won't go down well with the International Olympic Committee now that rugby sevens is an Olympic sport. Meanwhile, there are predictions that the race for World Rugby's chairmanship could end in a photo finish, with voting apparently split largely on north-south lines. And Totai Kefu says the latest intelligence points to Fiji having what might well prove to be the casting vote, and that will be in the hands of the FIU's president, Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama.
From having some conversations with some World Rugby people, that's what I've heard.
So the reports that I've seen suggesting that it literally could be Frank Bainimarama's election to decide, would that be a reasonable assessment of the state of affairs now?
From all the conversations that I've had, it could go down to that vote. It's probably 50-50 at the moment.
Potentially having the leader of a country having the final say on such an important decision for rugby really just brings into focus the very issues about integrity and high standards and political neutrality.
However, Ben Cisneros' suggestion that rugby and politics should be separated may not play out well in the Pacific, in the opinion of Totai Kefu.
80% of our budget is dependent on World Rugby investment. The other 20% comes from our government. So they need to still have active involvement, but also, they're a main stakeholder. Unless we're taught how to generate other avenues, we still need those two parties to be actively involved.
Across the sporting world, there is an element of public funding that goes into sport, but in the Pacific Islands, this might be a little bit higher as a percentage of the overall than in other places, and therefore, it might be thought there should be some sort of government input, given that it's government money being spent. But I do think that probably the principles that we've been discussing probably override that concern. I think that the overall image of the game is more important than almost having this say because you put money in. I think there should be processes in place that those in charge of running the game are trusted to a sufficient extent to acknowledge the receipt of these funds and to deal with them properly.
The X factor in all this is COVID-19. With no rugby being played anywhere in the world right now, Totai Kefu says the spotlight is on the election for chairman in a way that the sport has never seen before.
It's forced everyone to really focus at this election. Because there's no rugby going on, the power players are really looking at what this election can do, not only for themselves, but for their union. I think this is probably a right time for a bit of a shake-up at that level.
In his support for Gus Pichot to replace Sir Bill Beaumont, Kefu describes the Argentinian as a maverick, but a breath of fresh air. But even if he wins, can he then persuade enough council members to support him on what could be a series of landmark changes? When it comes to governance, Ben Cisneros thinks he can.
Significant changes to regulations need a certain majority in the council, and that can be difficult to put through if the big unions aren't in favour. That said, I think changes that just make the governance of the game better shouldn't face too much of a struggle in that regard, because ultimately those unions stand to benefit the most from a game that is more in line with modern standards and therefore more appealing to sponsors. And I think there will be change on the governance side.
And the result of the battle to be chairman of World Rugby will be announced on May the 12th.
Richard Hewitt reporting there.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
This is Pacific Beat and my name is Jordan Fennell. Soon you are going to hear from a group who are working to get Pacific and Maori families in Australia healthy during the coronavirus pandemic. But first, it's Friday. We've made it to the end of the week and I think it's time for a bit of Friday music. This is Jessica Malboy and Lou Bennett with Yellow Bird.
Yellow bird, up high in banana tree. Yellow bird, you sit all alone like me. Did your lady friend leave the nest again? That is very bad, makes me feel so sad. sky away, you're more lucky than me. Yellow bird up high in banana tree. Yellow bird, you sit all alone like me. Better fly away in the sky away. Pick a coming soon, pick from night to noon. Black and yellow you, like banana too, they may pick you someday. Wish that I was a yellow bird, I fly away with you. But I am not a yellow bird, so I see nothing else to do. Yellow bird, yellow bird, yellow bird.
What a beautiful song just to ease into Friday morning, the last day of the week. That was Jessica Malboy and Lou Bennett with Yellow Bird.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Staying fit and healthy can be difficult on a good day, but during the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of families across Australia are struggling because gyms and pools have been closed. But a group of people are out to change that, encouraging Maori and Pacifica families across the state of Queensland to get up and get active. Marla Damati chatted with Brent Matautia, the multicultural health coach with the Good Start program, to find out more.
Kia ora. Hello,
Falava.
Malo Lili.
Kia ora na.
Bula Banaka.
Hello, Wanta.
Namaste.
Hello. My name is Robas. Chris.
Brent. Deborah.
Denisa.
Emma.
Margo.
Sike.
Sebastian.
Diana.
Elkin.
Katarina.
Devita.
Daphne. And we are from the Good Start program.
So, well, Tala Falava. My name is Brent Matautia. I am Samoan and I am a multicultural health coach from the Good Start program.
Well, welcome to our first ever live streaming service. This is the first time we have ever done this, and it's a way where our Good Start team, you can get to know us a bit better, and two, you can learn something from us.
Now, Brent, can you tell us about the Good Start program? How did it actually start?
The Good Start program was created in 2006 to address the challenges of obesity and chronic disease in Māori Pacific Island community. With this program, we use evidence-based practices with identified Māori and Pacific Islander workforce to support children and their families in a culturally appropriate way.
With COVID-19 and obviously people moving to working from home and being at home with, you know, kids around, how has it been, or what's the experience been like moving your work that you do onto an online platform?
To be honest, it has been quite challenging, but rewarding at the same time. We find with Māori and Pacific Island communities is that because we're so family orientated, a lot of our programs are run face-to-face and within our family's homes, or within large groups, because that's how we are. We are very much like people. I think what we call in Samoan language is called tala noa, which means to have conversations without restriction. And we use a lot of cultural elements in our program to gain a trust from our families and our communities. I think one of the challenging things is how do we adapt that aspect of using tala noa and using the face-to-face interaction onto an online platform. So we have try to adapt our services as best we can to kind of still integrate like our cultural practices and our cultural elements via technology, like using Microsoft Teams or video calling and our Facebook page to try and still engage our families and our communities.
Now, speaking of your Facebook page, I see that you are constantly uploading videos on cooking and being active and little activities. How do you guys come up with the content to post on your Facebook page, and how do you feel like people are engaging with your content?
Yeah, so basically the content that we run on our Facebook Live sessions is pretty much the content we run in our face-to-face sessions when we coach our families or in our schools. So basically we've just taken our content, which we run, and we've kind of put it onto a live for pretty much our whole community to see. And we've kind of made it more practical so that people can actually practice these things at home. When we do this, we want to make sure that, you know, I think Māori Pacific Island community is a vulnerable population in Queensland. So we want to make sure that, you know, things that we do are affordable, they're easy to do, that everyone can do it in the family, kids as well as parents. We've seen our communities engage with it in terms of they have either done the workout with their kids and they're telling us about it, or they're making the recipes at home and they're taking photos of it and submitting their pictures. So it's been a great way to engage with a lot more people in our community, not just people in Queensland, but people outside of Queensland as well.
Why is it important, especially during this time, to connect with the Pasifika and Māori community in Queensland and around Australia and bring messages and initiatives like this?
Especially coming from our standpoint is that we try to educate Māori Pacific Islander families to be healthy and support them. And I think especially during this time with COVID-19, pandemic is that a lot of people we're seeing now are at home. So obviously the main things they're going to be doing at home is probably being on screen time and sitting down. So we want to make sure that, you know, while people are at home, they can have things to do with their kids. And it's especially important with these communities that the approach is holistic and that all these things that we're doing is with the entire family, not just the parents, not just the children, but as a collective. So we really want to try and promote good health and well-being during this time while everyone's at home. So if it means getting outside of the house in your local suburb and going for a walk, changing a recipe that you love that's maybe not as healthy, but providing some tips on how to make it better and healthier for you. So trying to adapt things so that people can still live healthier lifestyles during this time and while they're at home with their families.
For you personally, what have been some of the more fun or enjoyable videos to both film and create?
For me personally, I think last week I did a home workout with my sister's kids.
All right. Hey, good starters. Those of you who are just tuned in, welcome back to our live channel. It's good to have you back. And for those of you who are new to our channel or our Facebook, welcome to our life. Today we're going to be doing a little workout which you can do at home with us as well. If you're sitting there sliding through your news feed and you're watching TV at the same time, why don't you get up and do some physical activity with us? These are my nephews and my niece.
So I love doing that one because it was something practical that pretty much anyone can do, regardless of your age, because you know the movements weren't that hard. And also I love the cooking ones because the food that we make on our channel are mostly inspired from Pacific culture. And so you know, we hold those traditions and those recipes close to our heart, and we love to kind of educate our people about the cooking and how to make things healthier, and also not just talk about those things but also the cultural aspect. I think that has a deeper connection with our people, and those are the main things that I like personally in terms of delivering these Facebook Lives, is the education, not necessarily and only about healthy living, but also from a cultural aspect and point of view.
And finally, what message would you like to give Pasifika and Māori families at this kind of time of uncertainty?
Just to continue to listen to what the government says, you know, in terms of the social distancing and, you know, having good hygiene and practicing good hygiene. Also, now is also a time to, because we're all at home together, is to really establish or reconnect with your family and find better ways to connect with your family and keep fit and healthy together. And also do things together as family. So that means cooking together, involving your children when you go for a walk. I think those are the messages to, during this time, it can be, you know, because of social distancing, it can be, we can feel kind of segregated from everyone. But I think this is also a good opportunity to still really connect with your close ones and to do things together.
That was Brent Mathautia, the multicultural health coach with the Good Start program, which is working in conjunction with the Queensland government, speaking there to Marla Damati.
Maintaining a safe distance between yourself and others is very important to slow the spread of coronavirus. When saying hello and goodbye to people you meet, it's important not to shake hands, hug, or kiss. A safer way to greet people is to simply wave and smile without touching. If you are interacting with someone who is coughing or sneezing, you should avoid physical contact entirely and stay 1.5 meters away from them. This will reduce the chance of spreading the virus.
That is all for Pacific Beat this morning. Don't forget that Richard Hewitt will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. But stay with us on ABC Radio Australia. And remember to check out our ABC Radio Australia Facebook page to get all the latest news and developments from around the region. And if you are all over social media, we're also on Twitter at Radio Australia. That's where you'll find us if you want to tweet at us. All the stories you've heard here today, you'll be able to find on our website. Just type in Pacific Beat to your preferred search engine. Remember, during these unprecedented times, it only takes one person to put everyone else at risk. So this weekend, remember to be kind, stay home, and save lives. We'll catch you next week.